Welcome everybody to the Reflex Blue Show. I am your host, Donovan Beery, recording still from the Hyatt here at the 2015 HAL Conference in wonderful, windy Chicago. Actually, today's a nice day.
85 degrees today.
Yeah, I came in here like 2 days ago and it was
freezing.
It looked like Chicago.
Foggy, cold.
Yeah, I'm like, you can't see more than 10 stories up on these buildings that you know are taller.
So true.
So, and I have, you know, I have with me Jessica Helfand. Jessica, how you doing?
I'm doing well, Donovan. Thank you for having me.
Now, what are you speaking about here? Now, you're speaking with Michael Beirut about your observatory.
I was meant to. I had a little derailment on the way out, and I was under the weather, so he did it solo. But this afternoon, I'll be speaking with someone from Mohawk, someone from Blurb, and a magazine editor about curating content for publications.
Yeah, and you've been well known. Well, you're the says you got a 2013 AIG medal.
I did.
So you've been. It's like a lifetime achievement thing.
It means
you've done some things.
So now can I retire?
Yeah, I don't know how that works. I don't. Does it come with like a big like a pension fund?
It would be nice.
Yeah.
Yeah, right. And it's not a MacArthur. No, it's not one of those genius grants. But it certainly was a wonderful honor, and I was very honored to have it.
And yeah. I think and the things I think you were best known for is both your publications and Design Observer.
Design Observer
as of now, right?
Right. Exactly. Yeah. So we started Design Observer in 2003. It was Bill Drentel and Michael Beirut and Rick Pointer in London. And we started it as a blog because in 2003, a blog was a thing. We would write, people would comment. It was a simpler time.
And oh, yeah, I was one of the writers of the Be a Design Group.
That's right.
And so, yeah, it was
Speak so Up, you would
Be
agree.
A Design Group, and it was Design Observer were kind of the places you had to go in 2003.
And we did. It was before that was social media back then, right? So we would. Metrics were very simple. We weren't looking at Google Analytics. We were looking at comments. And it was conversational. And people would follow it and hit refresh screen to see what new thing had happened. And, of course, that's really changed now. So we're trying to shake things up a bit and do some different initiatives with Design Observer. But at its core, we still care deeply about our readers and try to write things that they want to read. It's just that people aren't reading quite the same way online as they were 13 years ago, 12 years ago.
Well, there's a lot more places to read. I think it kind of scatters around.
And people's attention spans are remarkably brief.
Well,
just remarkably brief. I mean, they always were, but...
Yeah.
But, you know, of course, journalists, I think, lament the fact that the short attention span that really, I think, characterizes most readers has led to the listicle and the very short sound bite. And it's difficult if you want to write... There's something between that, I think, in long-form journalism, which is called a few more paragraphs.
Right.
But not Twitter and not Vine. So
give it another 3 years and every article on Design Observer will be like, top 13 ways to tear a level
I think my whole team would quit.
Seconds.
I think they would link arms and quit in protest if it came to that.
Okay.
But it's funny, you try to stay principled and stay on message. And our mission has always been really to write about design, sort of cast a wider net around design and write about things that... through the lens of design, but maybe for readers who aren't us. And that's becoming a very interesting proposition for us. So
yeah, because when we started up, as I said, they're just a few blogs, but they were very much geared towards other designers commented.
Right.
And somewhere along the road...
Design became a thing you saw on the cover of Time magazine, right?
Yeah, and when a magazine like gets a new logo, it's like, that becomes a news article.
Right, exactly.
Like CNN reporting on like a logo? That's crazy.
Exactly, and they do. Everyone has an opinion, and it... We've been talking, many of us at this conference in particular, about the vicissitudes really that go along with design and its democratization, right? So the minute Fast Company is writing about design as Fast Company Design, but then they're writing for a market of people who aren't designers, and all those people have tools, and you know, in fact, websites look better, things look better, tools are better. Design education has really made it possible for a lot of people that were previously us. Now everybody can do many of the things we could do. And so, but the flip side of that for us is, how do you write for these people and provide content for these people and engage them into what is a much more interesting audience for all of us? Much more, you know, the bad side of democratization is that everybody has an opinion and they're not afraid to share it.
Correct.
The good side of it is there's a lot more people at the party, and maybe it's going to shake things up for us in a good way. I think it is.
Okay. It really has elevated our profession.
Let us hope.
I mean, it elevated the knowledge that our profession exists.
I think so, absolutely. And, you know, there's no hold barred to education and to access and to, you know, really beautiful templates on Squarespace and to, you know, easy printing with Moo and Blurb and all of these people who are here at the show. You know, it used to be you'd go to these trade shows and there were pretty things to pick up, but now these people, they're doing some interesting work and they're collaborating with designers in interesting ways and making things accessible to the world in a new way. So I think it's a great time to be here and be making work and to be engaged with all these inspirational people. Okay. We're just trying to do our part, our right. little part at Design Observer.
Okay. And where do you see Design Observer going in the next couple of years? I mean, because you've branched out with Michael Beirut with
yes.
your observatory podcast.
We have. We're loving doing our podcast, which is a bi-monthly podcast, very much modeled on the Slate Culture Gab Fest, where we pick a couple of topics that are on our minds and in the air, and we talk about them. We are looking at how we might create some initiatives around what we think we do well that aren't only online. So, for example, we've entered into a two-year partnership with Blurb to look at a number of publishing incentives. For example, we're starting a new line of books called Observer Editions, which is based on many things we've published in 12 years. We think we have something like, you know, 12 years of content. That's a lot of content.
Oh, sure.
Big archive. We're starting a quarterly journal called The Quarterly, which people can subscribe to.
So you're almost taking a lot of... are you going back into print then?
There will be an e-edition also, but we're really interested in actually working with Blurb to show that they're amazing printers. And they've proved that printing on demand is easy, it's affordable, it's sustainable, it's actionable. And what we're trying to do as kind of the thought leaders that Design Observer hopes we are seen as is to try to really cultivate a better understanding of how Blurb works with design and how designers can make use of Blurb. So there's a whole series of publishing initiatives with that. We had our first conference last year, which was on design and sound, and our next conference will be in San Francisco early next winter on design and food, okay. which we're very excited about. And you know, putting a typically Design Observer spin on things, which is to say,
yeah, what's
weird.
The difference? Because I know, you know, Armin's got his brand new conference, which is all like logo specific, and you
right.
know, it's just like, I think it's very like half hour talks from just a ton of people. Like that's his deal. I think,
right.
I haven't been to one, but I've heard great things. Like what's the spin on the Design Observer conference? Where are people going to find out information?
I think we'll be writing more about it and putting more promotional material out there as we get more clear about it. Our first conference was at SVA at the School of Visual Arts in New York last February. It was on design and sound, and it was really on design as a sort of cue to sound, and sound as a cue to design. So, for example, we had a singer-songwriter come and present. He's a professor at Yale and elsewhere, and he talked about the relationship between Gothic architecture and different kinds of architecture and choral music in churches and the sort of chant response mechanism of the design of a building and sound. We had a food blogger, Nicola Twilley, come and talk about the sounds that boll weevils make in grain silos so that grain silo designers can make better designed grain silos that are more impervious to the interference of insects and critters.
Does the sound of them...
Apparently, the sound is a cue that leads to different kinds of design initiatives, design decisions. So, you know, when we're in doing the food conference,
I can barely keep up with 2D design. Now then you go to the web, and then you start doing motion, and now we're dealing with sound.
But I think, you know, we're weird design. You know, we're old. Michael and I are older. We've been around a long time, and we're interested in design as it relates to things a little bit outside our comfort level. And bringing in people, you know, we're going to do this food conference. We're going to bring in an agrarian economist. I want to bring in farmers. I want to talk about the water shortage in California. I met a man in Paris last fall who's an engineering professor at Harvard who's really interested in pulverizing food and in the dissemination of air and food and nutrition and taste. And, I mean, that's a design conceit. Like, why air? How does air affect the way we make a thing? I think that's a Design Observer conference where, you know, the food will be great. We'll have, you know, there's food in California. What's not great about it? So I think that we're looking to see how we can branch out, but still stay on message with what Design Observer is, which is casting a wider net around design for people who maybe don't know as much about design as they want to, which doesn't mean writing about the new Pantone color for fall so much as it means writing about, you know, the design of the new...
Yeah, I have not even caught what the new Pantone color is. I do not keep up on what the
color
I'm supposed to use that year is.
I think I'm with you.
Okay.
Yep. Although I think Minion Yellow
Oh, okay. Now, what is the Pantone on it? I think like the Simpsons yellow is like you know.
There was an article actually. This was covered in like on Reuters a few weeks ago.
Okay.
That the Minions, who are of course these wonderful little yellow characters in the Despicable Me movies.
Which now that we have like a 2.5-year-old, we've seen them.
Yes, I do not have a 2.5-year-old, but I'm obsessed with them.
Okay.
And I wrote about them on Design Observer, and I was an early evangelist about how great these movies are.
Those are fun.
The Despicable
Me
movies,
they're
unbelievable
characters.
But apparently, Minion yellow is the first like named color to be introduced like branded through another vehicle, which is a movie, in a very long time.
Oh, it's actually, it doesn't have a
it's
number.
Actually called, it's actually, it may, it probably does have a number, but it is Minion yellow.
Okay, because I'm like, even though Tiffany, I know, it always has that secret swatch that's not in your book, that, you know, they're
right.
Blue or whatever, and they have swatch with whatever number it is, but it's like, does it exist, does it not?
Right.
But even they just got a number. They didn't.
Right.
They should
right.
just call theirs Tiffany Blue or something. Or
Minion Yellow,
Minion
baby.
Yellow.
You heard it here first,
and
or maybe not first.
It actually is, you know. But I'm just wondering, like, how close is that to the Simpsons Yellow? I'm gonna have to get some.
I think you are,
out.
And I think you're gonna have to sit down with your 2.5-year-old and have a serious conference about this, because
she. Oh, I have not talked to her about Pantone colors yet. I'm
well, this might
like
be the time. I think the moment has come.
As a father.
Yes, I have a friend who has a 2.5-year-old, and she proudly came home from daycare recently, and she said that her favorite shape was blue. And I fell in love with this child on the spot. So I teach a course at Yale on the color blue, so people that have blue stories, send them to me. And this one is going in my lecture.
That's wonderful. All right, we'll be right back with Jessica Helfand. Helfand?
Any way you want to say it.
I want to say it wrong.
Helfand, whatever you want.
Okay, we'll just call you Jessica H.
Well, that could be Jessica Hish, the type designer.
Yeah.
Jessica Helfand.
So, Jessica, what's up with Winter House? You've been at Winter House for a while.
So Winter House was, we bought it in 1998 and we renovated it. It was a painting studio in the Berkshires that was built by a man named Ezra Winter, who was a sort of unknown but extremely accomplished muralist in the first half of the 20th century. His big, big claim to fame was that he designed the mural at Radio City Music Hall called The Fountain of Youth.
Okay.
And he took his own life in 1949.
Oh.
We bought the house from some descendants of his, and we lived there, raised our children there, and I actually sold it a couple of years ago and moved to New Haven.
Oh, I'm sorry.
So I now live in New Haven, Connecticut, in a house that sort of looks like somebody took the old Winter House and put it in one of those packages
but
you
still
have when
the,
you travel.
But you still use the name for your
no,
design
No, I actually
company.
Shut the design studio down at the end of last year. Yeah.
Oh, I have not kept up. I'm sorry.
That's quite all right. Well, there was sort of no reason. You know about Bill, right?
Yeah.
So Bill was diagnosed in 2011. He fought the good fight, and we lost him at the end of 2013. And
that was it was a sad day for design.
Yeah, it was. And we had a wonderful memorial service for him a few months later. Sort of standing room only and wonderful eulogies from people. You know, he really was in many walks of life, and he had friends and fans and colleagues. He was a great believer in design, a great evangelist for design and designers, and he loved Design Observer. We used to say it was our third child. So I had to make a decision. We had Design Observer, we had Winter House. We started a nonprofit, a 501c3 called Winter House Institute, that has a wonderful small board that's really running itself, that focuses on design and social innovation, social entrepreneurship. So that's sort of running itself, and I call myself the uniparent. I couldn't, as a solo parent, run really three businesses. So
no, that's understandable.
I'm running Design Observer, and with my wonderful partner Michael Beirut and incredible team. We have two executive producers. I have an incredible assistant and wonderful executive editor who comes out of the art world and publishing, and we have correspondents now in Berlin and in London and in Paris, and hoping to add people in the Far East and in Asia and Africa. And really, I figure we have like another good year and a half ahead of us to see where these initiatives go, and you know, hopefully we'll succeed.
No, I mean, if I'm going to root for anybody, it's going to be Design. I mean, you guys have been, it's fun to see, because you guys, as I said, you started 2003, it was just kind of just another design blog in a way.
It was.
And now all of a sudden...
And Michael longs for those days. He's always talking about, remember when the site was just brown and orange? Can't we just go back to that? Michael, no, we can't go back to that. Your nostalgia is duly noted, but no, we can't do that.
Yeah, you can't. You're like, we're worldwide now.
That's right.
We don't just get, you know, comments from random people.
But it's hard. You know, I mean, you mentioned Armin before, and my hat is really off to him because I think his is the only site where the comments are lively and impassioned and ongoing. People feel really strongly. And you look at these posts on his site where you get many, many comments, and I think the rest of us really have not found that to be the case. So he's doing something right. He's very clear about what it is he's doing, and it's very entertaining to read.
It was also very evident from when he was running Speak Up that, I mean, that site was built for comments and to get it. And the way he writes, he has a way to elicit a response somehow.
Yes.
Like, so I think regardless, it's not just what he's writing on, but he's the one guy out there, I think, that his writing style is geared towards getting people to talk back.
Yes, I agree.
So, and I've always seen Design Observer, I mean, it's half educational, which is great, but a lot of times it's like, wow, I just learned something, and then you don't really know, you're like, I don't need to comment.
I am so happy to hear you say that. That is exactly what we're going for.
Okay.
You know, education's a funny thing. I mean, there's elite education. There's, you know, we have to admit that we practice in a world in which you don't need to be certified to practice.
Right.
So.
And I know there was always talk about should we certify designers and stuff, and then
that used to be
like,
a big topic, didn't it?
Yeah, and then it always came up. It's like some of the best designers we've had in the history have no education or whatever.
That's right. There are many people that are self-taught, not least of whom is Paul Rand. Who part of the reason I think he was this indefatigable maker and who was, you know, working till practically the day he died was that he was self-taught. He felt that he really needed to teach himself and the world something all the time. But I think one model for us, or for me at least, I can only speak for myself, is what the Cooper Hewitt does with education. And what Ellen Lupton in particular has done, you know, really with the books that she writes, her books on type, the program she's built at MICA and what she's done at the Cooper Hewitt. I mean, that's a view of education that's expansive. It's inventive, it's kind, it's principled. It's not, you know, anybody can do anything they want. But I think that the purview of what she has built as an educator through museum education and through proper education and through the writing of the books, I think that's been a great influence on me and on Design Observer. And as we try to understand, you know, when you're building any kind of business or brand, for lack of a better word, you look backwards at rethreading the needle of what you are, what people perceive you as, and yet you want to go forward and be mindful of what the needs are in the market and in education and in up-and-coming designers. So we're in an exciting moment, I think, with Design Observer. We're not trying to spread ourselves too thin, but we realize that there's got to be more than the sum of our parts, and that means, you know, moving a little bit away from what we've done, I think, well and consistently on the site, and realizing that the world's appetite for what we do might be a little broader and more diverse. And so how can we meet that need and keep growing?
Well, and I love that part of the answer is to make a physical publication again.
Thank you. We're pretty excited about it too.
But I know I also realize why you're putting this up digitally too, because the reach is always greater, it seems. It may not be as intimate.
Right.
But
you know, people love paper, and they love the design of paper. And Blurb, I don't think that everybody knows this, but they bought MagCloud from Hewlett Packard about a year ago, and so their capacity to do magazines, do publications.
Now, what's the MagCloud? Now, I know the Blurb because they do. You know, you can upload your books and you can print them.
Same thing with a magazine. You can go to their site and read about it.
So MagCloud was that, but magazine format.
Yeah, so it's like issue. It's right. I mean, so you can actually create a magazine that has a browsable embedded browser and be able to make your publication, have people see it online, but you can also print these quite beautiful publications. And the trim sizes are nice. They have nice, hefty spines. This afternoon, I don't know when this is going to be broadcast, but this afternoon...
This show's been over for a month and a half, so yeah.
So there's a magazine called Refueled, I think. Refueled. They recently did an issue with Aaron Draplin on the cover. Beautiful magazine printed by Blurb. So Blurb is not just books on demand, but you can do these sort of larger scale operations with magazines. And one of the reasons we're starting the quarterly, and we hope to be starting more magazines and talking about magazines as a... My background's in magazines. Sure. This is my DNA. I love editorial design, and I love the design of a magazine because there's something... kind of unprecious about it. You know, it can be timely and it can be dramatic, and you can have this beautifully gridded, structured departments at the front of the magazine, and then suddenly explode with possibility in the middle and the future. Well, and you can do that. So I want to bring back the magazine. I'm all for bringing back the magazine.
Who in the mass market, who's doing magazines right still? Is there anyone that?
I think that's an excellent question. I think there's a wonderful thing, I believe it's out of England, called Stack. And Stack is an independent, you're going to have to check me out on this, but Stack is an independent organization that you join it, you pay a certain amount of money, and they send you a magazine every month, okay. Different magazine. So you can actually experience these different, you know, from N+1 to Makeshift to where it works that Words That Work, to some of them are European, some of them are American, but I think the small batch publication, the kind of more artisanally brewed publication is coming back, because it's somewhere between a book and something that's on screen, and it can be both. You can make your publication and also have it accessible as an EPUB. But for people that want to have it on the coffee table, want to read it on the train or take it to the airport or you know, I think it's great. I mean, I still read The New Yorker every week. I read The New York Times Magazine every week. I read The Guardian online. And if I was in England, I would read that in print.
Sure.
But I also think there's something about design being in the public eye that makes the publication of a design publication potentially bigger than just about design. So you can use design as a vehicle to make a publication that, through the lens of design, engages people in different ways. And that's certainly what we're trying to do with the quarterly at Design Observer.
Wonderful. We look forward to seeing it.
Thanks.
So Jessica, what is it that, I don't think I've ever known, what is it that brought you into design in the first place? Like,
what a lovely question to be asked.
Was it magazines?
Back in the Teutonic era when I was a child. So the first thing I would say is that I grew up with a father who was a poster collector.
Okay.
And I was a very small little person, like very small. Like the kid who always was kneeling on the front row of the class picture was me. I was, you know, barely 4 feet for a very good part of my childhood. And there was something about the relationship between being tiny and living in a house full of enormous 19th century drug posters. So my father's collection, he was trained...
Where do you find a 19th century drug poster?
Well, I lived in Paris for many years.
Okay.
And my father was primarily a print collector. He was trained as a chemical engineer, and he worked for Merck. And we moved to Paris because he was running Merck in France. And there, his collection really blew up. I mean, he just started to buy these posters. But even before then, I remember, you know, I literally have an early memory of crawling up the stairs and seeing this big, you know, anti-syphilis poster or something on the stairs. So I mention this because this was one very important ingredient in my realization that design was this language that I have always seen as a form of theater. And I mention this because when I was in college, I was an actress, and I had to decide between design and acting. And I think very much my decision to go with design was that I missed it when I wasn't doing it. I was a very visual person. I loved making things. But I went to graduate school at a time when the sort of language of the international style and what I felt was a rather stultifying, but I realize in its day, was a kind of homogenizing the language of neutrality, how we could use, you know, humanist... post-war typefaces to reach people, that modernism was reductivism, all of those things that were so much part of the gestalt of design in the late 80s when I was a student just did not square with my knowledge of the theatrical French posters I'd grown up with.
Right.
And I feel like I've spent the majority of my life struggling between those two extremes. And, you know, if there's any future biographers of me out there who care, I think that's the story, right? To me, that's the story, that I was this kind of refusenik. You know, there I am at Yale studying with Paul Rand and Bradbury Thompson and Armin Hoffman, and everybody is just drinking the Kool-Aid and happy to do it. And I'm feeling like...
And they did great work.
Incredible work and amazing teachers, and I'm so happy to have had the discipline of that education. But a part of me was like this little, you know, gurgling volcano, struggling to break free and wondering why this world didn't look like the world I grew up in. And I think these were good extremes to live by, and I think they're still extremes that I live by. And I think, you know, if you look at, we were lucky at this conference to have this influx of Europeans. And one of the great things about Europe.
Yeah, I think that the talk that we're going to do after yours, the next podcast, we're having
Philippe.
No, we're having a guy from does packaging in Hong Kong.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
How exciting!
Yeah, so even our show is going international, I guess.
It's great. It's as it should. The
I think we also live in a time where like, you know, you look back in their history books and you have these motions where it's like, this is the design style of this time, this is the design style of this time. Design style now seems to be like everything.
It does.
Think you're extreme thinking, like now they're not extremes, it's just two different design styles.
Yeah, now there's much more tolerance and acceptance and appetite for these kinds of things than there was in the sort of my way or the highway days of the 1980s when I was a student. I was going to say, I was in Paris in the fall on sabbatical, and the posters that are done by French designers, a number of whom are here at this conference, are by their very nature of a scale that we do not do here. So when I acquired a Philippe Epelois poster a couple years ago, it was a real problem trying to get it through the front door of my house. I mean, they're just enormous. And they're, I mean, talk about theatrical.
Right.
Just about, they're half the size of the wall where we're sitting right now. I mean, they're just remarkable. And American sizes are not quite so gargantuan and dramatic, but it doesn't mean design can't be.
Yeah, and American sizes of everything seem so, like 8.5 by 11 seems to be the weirdest format sheet of.
And yet there's a whole super size me thing here in America, so go figure. It's fine with like drinking vessels, not so much with posters.
Yeah, but I mean, but even if they had like a large format poster, the proportions would be all off here.
Yes,
for some
they
reason.
Would be.
They'd be like,
they
oh, we'll print you a poster, and you're like, why are those proportions so weird? Can you trim it down? Don't have a cutter big enough.
Exactly.
So. What brought you then into the magazine world once you finish your education?
One of my first jobs out of grad school was I went to work for Roger Black, who's a type designer and a magazine designer, and we called it Roger Black Boot Camp. There were three of us in a room, it was about 15 by 20, redesigning magazines using what was probably, I don't know, Cork 2.0 maybe. I'm going to be generous here and say it wasn't 1.0, but
okay, sure.
Maybe 2.0. And I think I redesigned 15 magazines in the 10 months I worked for him. And it was an amazing baptism by fire. And one day someone called and said, we're looking for a design director for the Philadelphia Inquirer Sunday magazine. And everybody went, Philadelphia, who wants to move to... And I was secretly cheering because I had this adorable 98-year-old grandmother who I was just... obsessed with, who lived in Philadelphia, and I said,
oh,
I am
nice.
So in. I moved to Philadelphia and got to hang out with Minnie, my grandmother, and I designed a magazine every 4 days for, I think, 2.5 years. And
wow.
that was boot camp part two. And I realized I was the only designer, trained designer on a staff of 500 journalists. I worked with editors. I was there when the Gulf War broke out. We had an incredible stable of photographers, and we did amazing, uninterrupted 12, 14 spread stories on photojournalism. The magazine.
Quite different from the blogging of today. Four bullet points, yeah.
Exactly. It was really different. And it was an incredible challenge. And, you know, if you have to design a new magazine every 4 days, you can't get precious about your work. And I loved it. And so I've always come back to editorial and more magazines than books even, because I love that the content is so diverse. And so you as a designer are kind of like a conductor in a symphony trying to, you know, make sure that, you know, the wind section isn't getting overshadowed by the violins, and yet everybody's got to have their moment to shine. And so I love it. I find it a really technically complicated thing to do, but enormously challenging and very gratifying.
Well, that's wonderful. Well, thank you so much for being on the show.
And, it was my great pleasure.
We'll keep up with you. Follow Jessica at Design Observer.
Design Observer and all our initiatives.
And the podcast is The...
The Observatory.
The Observatory.
Right. Available on iTunes and SoundCloud.
And I'm sure there's links to it from the Design Observer.
There are, and there always will be, as long as Design Observer keeps going, which I hope is a good long time.
Well, I mean, you're diversifying. If it shuts down here, it'll keep going up in Berlin or whatever.
Let us hope.
All right.
Thank you, Donovan. Thanks.
You didn't tell me that you got a book coming out. Of course, you got a book coming out.
Well, no, I'm a slow poke as a writer.
But I mean, you write a lot of books.
I only write one about every 6 or 7 years.
Okay.
The last book I wrote came out the day Obama was elected, so that's 8 years ago.
And Stephen Heller has literally already written probably 50 books since then.
Yeah, he's actually written 50 books since this conversation started today.
Yeah, I mean, when we had him on the old show years ago, I think, like, what are you working on? Rattle off like 5 books.
You know what our joke always was at Winterhouse? That if there was ever like a moment where we didn't hear from Steve Heller, that he was writing our obituaries. That he was like, his secret pet project that he didn't talk about was designer obits.
You know, here's my advice for you guys. So on Design Observer, you need to get them all ready. You need to have Stephen Heller load them all up.
Right, and we're just ready to break the stories
right.
The minute they tank.
And just make sure you don't mess up like CNN every now and then and like accidentally publish the Dick Cheney one. Like, well, you know, right. How they always accidentally do that. And then that's when it comes out that they're actually written ahead of time. And you're like, oh, that's bad.
Exactly.
But okay.
Yeah, fact-checking needs to be fact-checked.
Make sure they stay in draft mode.
That's right.
In the background.
Exactly. So this book is a long time coming, and my joke with my team is that when the book comes out, I will have to join the Witness Protection Program, or maybe start one for graphic designers. Because the book is critical in a kind of a bigger way.
Now, is the book about you, or what's the title?
The book? Okay, so the title...
Hey, I know these might be working titles.
They're working titles. Let me just start by saying that Yale University Press, my publisher, is doing a series of books organized around the editorial conceit of why things matter. So, Paul Goldberger did the one on why architecture matters. There's one on why romanticism matters by Peter Gay, the historian. There, Alice Waters will write the one on why food matters. And I was asked to write on why design matters. Now, because Debbie Millman has a show called Design Matters, and because there is a wonderful program run by Mariana Amutulo at Art Center called Design Matters, it's language that has other reference points for our profession. And the more I wrote the book, the more I realized I was writing about something a little bit different. And also, because it is a book about design, I want to design it so that it looks a little bit, with all due apologies to Yale University Press, it can't be part of the series visually because it's about more than that. So,
the visual should.
That's my preamble.
Well, I'm gonna say your title should go with the clickbait thing where 37 ways design matters more than the Kardashians. You'll get more clicks. You'll get more sales.
I thought about Eat, Pray, Design.
Okay.
Instead of Eat, Pray, Love. You know, of course, Adrian Shaughnessy already did How to Be a Designer Without Losing Your Soul, but that's where
That's a good title.
That's where I'm going with this. Yeah. So the current working title is Rules of Engagement, Why Design Matters. Because about how we engage with who we are as individuals in the world, as moral, sentient beings. And I know that sounds really heavy to talk about on your radio show, but...
And you might get away with it because that David Spade show, Rules of Engagement, is no longer on the air.
Yes, or I could have David Spade give me a cover blurb.
Ooh.
I'm not sure that will be the title. But the background on this is that I was on a jury in Amsterdam a few years ago, and it was a student design prize, and a student had made a film that was basically an edit of a bunch of guys sitting around in flak jackets doing a sort of terrorism video.
Okay.
And he had used his immense skill to ape the form of a terrorism video and kind of re-engineered it so that it was a way to raise money to fund a revolution. And he wanted to put this on Kickstarter.
Sure.
So it was subversive, it was inventive, it was kind of edgy. And everyone on the jury thought it was really great. And I was apoplectic because I thought it was irresponsible, that we're not teaching our students that when they make things and put them out online, they travel unmoored from their points of origin
right. Without
the innuendo and the irony with which they were intended. And I suddenly felt as a mother and as an educator and as a writer, somebody has to write about this. And I decided that person was me. So the book is 15 essays about things like design and authority, design and humility, design and consequence, design and sadness, design and patience, and really looks at the culture we are creating with a very kind of circumspect eye. Critical, yes, but I think more than that, circumspect. So, you know, we talk about disruptive technologies. We talk about hacking, which is a really vitriolic word because it presumes that you're taking something somebody else made and you're undoing it to make something else.
Right.
So what is the honor in actually being a person in the world that breaks and enters to make a new thing. So it's kind of a philosophy book. And it's funny in places. It's poignant in places. I wrote it under near monastic conditions in Paris. Most of the book was written while I was in Paris last year. The reference points in it are as much about world events, current events, tragic events, 9/11, natural disasters, as they are about design events. And there's certainly many reference points that are visual and will be recognizable to readers who've read books that I've written in the past. But I felt the book needed to be written because I think we're at a moment as designers where if we are going to inhabit a world that's larger than us and we are going to traffic in these unprecedented vulnerabilities that come up when we're dealing with people that are not just specking colors, then we have to really engage a bigger worldview of ourselves, sort of the humanitarian role we play as designers beyond just being practitioners. And that's what the book's about.
Yeah, and I know it's hard sometimes because we all have like day-to-day work and we're like, we can't think beyond this project, but you do need to step back and say like, once I'm done with this PowerPoint, there's something else I need to probably do.
Right. What happens with that PowerPoint when it goes out in the world and somebody Snapchats it and then it's picked up and it's moved? And there's something about the movement with which the things we make get disseminated. We used to, you know, remember back in the days of the town crier?
Yeah,
man held up a poster.
It's like immediate.
It's so fast and you can't protect your work.
Gap can announce a logo and kill the logo in one day now.
And everybody has an opinion about the logo in between.
Yeah.
And it doesn't really matter that you went to school and have 15 degrees in making a perfect logo. You can get slammed, and you can get slammed in a big, broad way really quick. So it's a pretty weird moment, and in some ways a very toxic set of conditions with which we put our work out there in the world. And the more all of us are designers, the more none of us are designers. So I think since we were designers first, we need to take a step back and say, how can we behave honorably? So that our children and grandchildren and students and their children and grandchildren understand that design at this moment was not unaware of its role in a larger world. And that's really why I felt this book had to be written.
All right, and when's the book coming out?
And now I'm joining the Witness Protection Plan. spring of 2016.
All right, well, you have until the spring of 2016 to join the plan.
Right, so if you see me at a conference wearing a big nose and a mustache, you'll know why.
All right, sounds great. Well, I need to get a big nose and a mustache as well.
We can have a little fist bump.
Little
nose, mustache, fist bump.
Yeah. All right, well, thank you. Thanks. We'll catch up with you later.
Thanks, Tom.
The Reflex Blue Show with Donovan Beery is hosted at 36point.com. Music by Dustlab. Find out more at myspace.com/dustlab.